Hey, this is John Williams. How are you doing? I hope you're doing well. We are at WGN Radio, and here comes another exciting edition of the Mincing Rascals. Literally, just as we were getting ready to walk into the studio to record it, Steve Bertrand had to walk out. The mayor had some cross words for the city, so you won't hear Steve Bertrand this week, but the rest of the familiar voices are there. And here's a familiar word from our friends at the Joint Relief Institute. Listen, all those people that were walking on the lakefront and got our lakefront shut down had healthy knees, or at least pain-free knees, and someday I want you to join them again. I want you to be able to walk and move about pain-free. And that's what the Joint Relief Institute is all about. Here's what they do. They use digital imaging to see where your knee tissues have deteriorated. They painlessly put a joint lubricant into that spot. It's all they do. They are expert at this, and I'm telling you, it works. So this quick, non-surgical, pain-free procedure that's almost surely covered by your insurance is still up and running. Their business is considered necessary, and they are treating people's knee pain. So don't have knee pain. It's the same number for both Oak Brook and Orland Park, 708-888-0000, as in zero pain. Today is Thursday. It's March 26th, I've been told. It's 12:40 in the afternoon. I'm John Williams, and this is the Mincing Rascals, a podcast we record at the studios of WGN Radio and parts throughout Chicagoland.
I'm Heather Sharone of The Daily Line.
I'm Austin Berg, Vice President of Marketing at the Illinois Policy Institute.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the obediently isolated columnist from the Tribune.
We are all using Zoom. I'm not on my studio microphone, so if we sound slightly different than we normally do today, that's the reason. And everybody else is, Zorn, I see you on the video component here. You are at the Tribune right now, right?
I'm not. This is an artificial background. I fooled you with my background here.
Are you kidding me?
No, you can set your own background image. And I set the Tribune newsroom as my background.
See, I'm the boomer. You're a boomer, too. I didn't realize you could do that. You've got a picture of the Tribune and you made that your background, huh?
I have, yes.
Heather and Austin, though, are... Looks like you guys are at home, right?
In the year
2000.
I've got my cool Chicago neighborhood map behind me, letting you know that I'm a real one.
We're going to do Brenda and I are doing our first Zoom cocktail party this evening with another couple. And I was wondering where I would position the camera to get a comfortable visual for our friends. I could fake it like Eric. It wouldn't matter, right?
That's how this brave new world works all of a sudden.
I'll walk you through. It later, John.
I actually think this is a pivot point for people for a lot of reasons, socially and business-wise. Austin, would you agree with that? Do you see people like me or my parents or even your generation seeing new opportunities or something like that?
Absolutely. And I think it's benefited the places that are already the most nimble and the people who have been early or mid adopters of this kind of stuff. I think it's really benefiting them. At the same time, there are so many norms that are going to need to change over the next few months and over the next few days, as we saw in that press conference from Lori Lightfoot yesterday. I've stopped riding my bike on the 606 after seeing photos of what that looked like yesterday, that 14-foot path that was just crowded with people on a nice day. And I have a PSA for all the people on that path. Every street is now the 606. There are no cars anywhere. I rode my bike around like 2 or 3 miles on Lincoln Avenue today, and it was eerie. I think 2 or 3 cars passed me on my left, and one was a bus.
It's my understanding that in New York City that they have closed many of the streets to traffic already. We're seeing in New York is what we're probably going to see in Chicago in a week or less. That's sort of the leading edge of this pandemic. So you're going to be, I don't know if you're going to be allowed to ride your bike on the street. It's unclear to me exactly what all these new restrictions are mean to people who want to get out and go for a jog in their neighborhood, or I guess you got to walk your dog still, and you're allowed to walk to the pharmacy, be allowed to drive to the supermarket, I assume. I don't know. This is kind of brave new world stuff as far as what we're going to be facing.
The mayor has said, go out, get exercise, but this isn't a time to train for a 5K along the lakefront. It's not a time to, you know, hang out with your buddies, you know, go out and get what you need and then go back home. And, you know, the first day of real spring in Chicago is a citywide holiday, right? We all go outside. We all, you know, at least grab a coffee outside. And yesterday, the timing was just bad because it was just at the start of this stay-at-home order, which is what everybody says is really what it's going to take to stop the spread of coronavirus.
Yeah, as much as I loved yesterday, I thought this is bad. For instance, today, Thursday, it's a little foggier. It's going to be rainy for the next few days. So in a way, if the weather yesterday was like it's going to be for the next few days, I don't think we'd have this closure of the lakefront that the mayor instituted. I was on the lakefront yesterday at 2 o'clock, and Austin, it was crazy. It was like a summer day. It was insanely crowded, and everybody still had sort of a 6-foot distance, but the entire lakefront was filled with people doing their best to maintain a 6-foot distance, and it felt a little irresponsible.
And that's what I've been hearing from a lot of people who are on the lakefront yesterday. And how about that change in tone from Lightfoot and from Beck yesterday? It was really stark.
And do not let the warming weather let your guard slip.
If you violate it, you are subject to a citation, a fine of up to $500. And if you continue to violate it, you will be subject to physical arrest.
And it reminded me of that SNL sketch where Will Ferrell is kind of innocently grilling burgers, and then he flips a switch and yells viciously at his kids to get off the shed.
Great landscaping job. Did you do that yourself?
You bet. Hey, there's going to be a meeting between your ass and the palm of my hand if you don't get off the shed. Now get off the shed!
And it made sense in the context of how many people were on the lakefront yesterday. And one, I mean, I'd be curious about Heather's thoughts on this, but it was clear that she was angry, and it was clear that Beck was angry, probably for good reason. But what wasn't clear to me is what are the specific guidelines about being in a public place or a park besides the 6 feet? Because, you know, passing someone when you're jogging or biking, is it okay or is it not? Or at what point is it too dense where that isn't okay? I don't know if I came away from that press conference with good answers to those questions, but I might not have been paying attention.
Well, it's a little bit unclear because the mayor has been saying, stay away from people, keep 6 feet in between each other. So at first it was, don't be within 6 feet of somebody for more than 10 minutes. And now it's, don't pass them on the sidewalk at all. And I think that is because so many of the new cases of coronavirus are being transmitted by people who are not symptomatic. So the last time the Illinois Department of Public Health answered these questions, 4 out of 5 new cases were transmitted by somebody who was not showing signs of illness. So given that, I think it's really prompted people and the governor to really rethink these orders, which means that go outside, go out for a walk. But I've been going out with my girls and, you know, we've been crossing the street. We've been waving at people from, you know, far enough away. But it's just not worth the risk, especially because we've already sacrificed so much. You know, if this is going to pay off, we're not going to know for at least another 2 weeks.
When you're out for your walks, Heather, when you see people coming at you on the sidewalk, do you like cross the street? Do you go out in the street? How do you handle that?
I have been. I've been crossing the street. My husband's been out with the girls too. He's a little bit less freaked out than I am, I think. But, you know, they're saying, you know, stay on the other side of the street, wait for people to pass. You know, I have a 7-year-old who loves dogs, and, you know, the last thing I want is for her to see somebody she knows and see a dog that she knows and goes running towards them. And then, you know, I would imagine it would be a lot of sleepless nights for me worrying about, you know, whether she had picked something up or, you know, because you just don't know. You just don't know. And that's, I think, the scariest part about this is that there's just so much that we still don't understand about how this virus is transmitted.
Well, as you were saying, it's transmitted often by people who are asymptomatic.
Yeah.
John, you're coming into work, right? You're talking to us from beautiful studios at WGN right now, right?
That's right.
How are you getting about? I mean, I'm staying home, basically. I don't leave the house much as possible. But how are you handling all this?
Well, I normally take the train, of course, but we do have a car. So Brenda stays home. I just drive in. I park about 3 blocks from here and I walk. I had the thought this morning, Eric, that if you listening to this podcast in the city suburbs or wherever ever thought, I want to drive around Chicago or Lakeshore Drive, this would be a great time to see our city. There is nobody down here. Last week, was it with you guys? I've done this on the radio, I know, too. I could do it for you again right now. I love this little game I play where I look out the 18-story window we're in, and you know how busy Lakeshore Drive is, and I do a car count for you. You want me to do another one?
I can't yes. wait.
Yes,
go.
Okay.
Go. great radio.
Okay, here the Lakeshore Drive, 7 lanes I'm looking at right now. It was this way during rush hour today. Here we go. One. Waiting for another car. Waiting for another car. Two. That's how busy Lakeshore Drive is right now.
Wow. I just talked to a UPS driver who I yelled to him across the street, and he said that his shift is normally about 9 hours, but there's so little traffic that he can get all his packages delivered now in about 6 hours. So he's loving it.
What do you think of the difference, though? And this kind of goes to the point Austin was making, where how subjective is the decision, right? Like, are they going to run around with tape measures? And if enough people violate the 6-foot barrier, then the red flag goes up. How do you know? Lori Lightfoot, like the governor a couple weeks before, just got mad, I think, and said, that's it. It's over. The president is really doing almost the exact opposite, right?
Ultimately, the goal is to ease the guidelines and open things up to very large sections of our country as we near the end of our historic battle with the invisible enemy. I said earlier today that I hope we can do this by Easter.
So I think that's a legitimate calculation to make. You have to err on whatever side you think you need to err on, but you can't have both right now. And the mayor is deciding health is paramount, and the president, is this your read on it too, guys, is the exact opposite.
Which sets up a real problem, because what happens if Governor Pritzker extends the stay-at-home order past when it's scheduled to expire right now on April 7th? And what if the president goes on television and says, wait a minute, it's over, it's done, go back to work, we've got to restart the economy? As I understand the legal aspect of it, the governor's order trumps action, no pun intended, but so that sets up a terrible conflict.
I asked a doctor about that the other day. I said, since they're not synchronized, we're in day 10 as we sit here today, Thursday, of the federal petition to stay 15 days apart. And obviously the states is not until April 7th. So they're not going to be synced up anyway. And the doctor said he felt that he thinks pockets can be contained, that he wasn't as worried about that. But I thought that's hugely problematic.
I think Heather's right in her interpretation of the law. The states reserve what are called police powers. And the reason that states have those powers is so they don't run into constitutional barriers when stuff like this happens. I think one thing that I have seen, there are so many problems with those press briefings, but one thing that I have appreciated is a line that Pence has been saying, and he's been saying it for a while, that the response should be locally executed, state managed, and federally supported. And I think the reason that you're seeing a lot of deferment to the governors is because, one, they have better knowledge than does the federal government about what's going on in their backyard. And two, all these states are just on different trajectories. So it might be a little bit unwieldy to get the feds to step in on such a broad basis to apply things to 50 states equally.
My sense, I guess we're all amateur epidemiologists now, right? But my sense is that this, we started off with, one case in Washington, and now we're up to, 20, what is it? I don't even know what the number is in the U.S. now, but.
Nationally, I think we're over 1,000 deaths. In Illinois, we're over 1,000 people with the illness.
In any case, this is a particularly virulent strain, and it seems to spread itself very easily. And so the fact that they have, a handful of cases in West Virginia, for instance, doesn't mean that it's not going to wallop West Virginia because of the way that it spreads. So it does seem to me like those governors who get out in front of this who say, like, look, I know we only have 10 cases in this state, but we're all staying home. Because, you know, they're talking about this whole idea of bending the curve, that if you don't get out in front of this, it's going to overwhelm you. And it's going to do what's happening in New York City right now, where the ambulance system and the hospital system is overwhelmed. And you can see that coming here unless we take, you know, unless we get lucky, I guess, and take some really serious measures. So the idea of there being this kind of state by state response, yeah, I guess it does make sense because some states are hit harder than others. But it does seem like there needs to be more, at least federal guidance on this, and it needs to be more aggressive. You know, Trump was saying that earlier this week that he wants everybody to go pack the churches on Easter Sunday, that he has this, thinks it's going to be over by then. You know, the public health experts that I've heard interviewed said that is crazy, that the curve's still going to be going up, and that if we do that, if we try to return to normal in the second week of April, we're just going to cause more disease and more economic hardship.
Well, so, not only that, but Washington, D.C. issued a stay-at-home order until April 24th yesterday. So that's not even possible. So I think that sets up the conflict. But we also are living in a time where people hear President Trump, and if they support him politically, they believe whatever he says, evidence to the contrary be damned. And of course, there's that terrible case of the man in Arizona who ingested fish tank cleaner because it included a chemical that the president has said is potentially a cure for coronavirus, and of course has not been substantiated in any possible way. So that, to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that seems to me to be the worst case scenario, where you have somebody like Governor Pritzker saying, nope, we need you to stay home, we're not through it yet. And you have somebody like the president saying, go out and buy tchotchkes, or, you know, go to the mall. And that, you know, could really not only spread the existing virus, but cause, you know, places where it's been tamped down to flare back up.
This whole conversation reminds me of how late Indiana seemed to be to the game. We carried the press conference that the governor of Indiana had on our radio station, and he was saying all of the things to his state that we had said several days earlier.
Hunker down Hoosiers. It's to make sure that we get through this storm as fast as humanly possible.
Did you think that the virus wasn't going to cross the state line? A large percentage of Indiana's population is in Northwest Indiana, right next to Chicago. And only then was he finally saying, we need to take this seriously.
I imagine that's the exact same dynamic that happened with countries where this spread very quickly. And then looking at U.S. Congress and the White House and saying, hey, guys, you might want to stop letting people into your country immediately, because we're on the other side of this curve and you guys haven't seen the worst of it yet, nowhere near.
One thing that I'm worried about is that this is going to turn into a partisan issue. You know, Trump supporters, and there are, I think, like something like 60% of the population now feels that he's handling this situation.
You're right.
Well,
it's 6-0.
Which is surprising to me, but that if you look, I did a column on this last week that I drew a lot of fire from Republicans on, but I pointed out that there is a significant gap in attitudes toward the coronavirus between Republicans and Democrats. Democrats have been taking this much more seriously. They've been much more likely to change their plans. And Republicans have been much more likely to follow sort of the Trump and Fox News guidance that this is kind of overblown. This will go away on its own like a miracle. And that pretty soon this idea of social distancing and everything else is going to become like a partisan signal, like Merry Christmas or something. It's going to be something that people are, rather than people all getting together, unifying and saying, we're going to isolate, we're going to fight this virus together. It's a battle between the parties. And that's dangerous. That's fatal.
I think the best example of that is what's happening at Liberty Baptist College. Right. The president of that school is a big supporter of Donald Trump. They're best buddies. And so I'm just reading from their webpage, Eric, while you were talking, I called it up. It says, as the coronavirus threatens to spread across Lynchburg, Liberty University officials are preparing to welcome back up to 5,000 students from spring break this week.
Yeah, this virus is not red or blue. It goes everywhere and affects everybody. And the thing is, like, you think, well, and I've heard from people saying, well, this is going to be Darwinism at work, all these people who don't work with the virus. But that's not necessarily true. Everybody who gets sick is spreading it to innocent people, people who are, you know, other families, other races, other parties, other, you know, it's like, it is not, you can, it's not like, you know, you just, you're going to be like eating a Tide Pod or something like that. It's this kind of stupidity really spreads everywhere.
Yeah, one of the I think your point's good about the partisanship and how hopefully this does not become a partisan signal. And one of the, I was thinking about that earlier this week, and I thought, well, maybe it's along the lines, as John said, of trust in institutions, especially trust in media outlets, and that you have a very strong overlap on the Venn diagram of Trump supporters and distrust for legacy media. The only wrinkle in that I was thinking about is you had left-leaning outlets or centrist outlets like Vox as recently as, you know, 3 weeks ago, saying how this isn't going to be such a huge deal. Or you had someone like Bill de Blasio, who now has an enormous egg on his face, if he didn't already, saying how everybody should go out to the movies and stuff. So maybe now the fact that the media largely has changed its tune still gives water to that theory. But I'm just thinking of all the mistakes that have been made, you know, 3 or 4 weeks ago across the aisle. Everyone.
What? Give me an example.
People saying that this is, you know, you shouldn't be worried about this. You shouldn't be panicking, because the partisan signal before all of this was doomsday preppers are the red meat conservatives, right? And then everybody else was, you know, reasonable, rational actors. And now it's totally flipped.
I am a little worried about all these people buying guns and ammo.
Yeah, I had a nice conversation with a gun store owner this week, and he didn't have any more of an explanation other than people feel threatened. They know they're not going to shoot the germ, but it's just when people feel threatened, this is what they do. They buy toilet paper and ammo.
It's crazy times right now, and people are doing things to make themselves feel comfortable. And if, you know, buying a gun is something they can feel more comfortable with, it's not a bad thing to have right now.
Did I misquote you that you guys have sold in the last week what you sold in the previous 6 months?
We're close. I would say 3 months.
Yeah, of course, again, the problem when you turn this into a partisan issue, it becomes the inability for all of us to get together and take the actions that we need to take. And that's just going to make everybody sicker. And I understand the president's desire to get the country moving again. This is, we haven't even really talked about the economic collapse that we're facing, but this is deadly serious. And I'm sure that, you know, all of us are facing that looming problem. And we would all like to get the country back to work. And yet, the people who study this stuff the most are telling us that it will only make the problem worse if we go back to work too soon. If we get rid of our social distancing and start clustering again, that it's going to cause an even worse spike and even greater damage to the economy. So it's not a simple like moral dilemma. It seems like a pretty easy call to say we need to continue this right now. Otherwise, we're going to be in a much bigger world of hurt, both medically and economically.
The president said more people will die, Eric, if we don't revive the economy. Not exactly sure how, but maybe healthcare services are compromised because the economy is down and therefore people become ill and die. I don't know how that happens, but that's one of his justifications. I think mostly he's not so concerned about our health. He's concerned about the economy. If that's an election issue for him, so be it. But I do think that's a legitimate conversation for the president of the United States uniquely to have, maybe a governor of a state too. Where should I err, on the side of public health? Or people ain't going to be able to retire now that we're planning on retiring in a couple of years unless we nip the economy thing in the bud too.
If I thought that he was taking advice from people who actually were seriously interested in what the best path forward is for both the economic and the literal health of the nation, then I would be much more confident in what he's prescribing. I just feel like he's looking at his reelection. He's looking at the stock market. He's looking at what his wealthy friends are telling him. He's not really looking at what people who know this stuff are telling him.
I think there's also a scale problem on the economic side, similar to the virus, where people couldn't comprehend, and I think we talked about this a couple weeks ago, people couldn't comprehend the rapidity with which it would spread, because there's a statistical, just our brains aren't able to simply comprehend that. The same thing with this news this morning of unemployment claims going past 3 million unemployment claims. The context there is there's currently a stock of around 5 million. So you just almost doubled your unemployment overnight. That's really serious. And I think, you know, the health consequences are one thing, but the despair of that scale of jobs loss should not be underestimated.
And there's a reason, what, Austin, to maybe entertain the president's concern.
Not necessarily how he phrased it, you know, let's get people back to work prior to Easter. I'm thinking more in terms of, you know, the emotional response of people who are seeing these jobless claims 10x overnight. And I think that has a lot to do with the nature of this bailout, which we should definitely talk about. It's the bailout from the federal perspective, to me, seems a lot different than the moral hazard of a bailout of the banks in 07-08. This is more, to me, compensation, similar to eminent domain, for emergency action rather than a bailout of people who didn't save enough money.
And is that a good idea in your mind?
I think really you have to be very specific in what you're talking about. So no strings attached, huge bailouts to major corporations, probably not a good idea. The small business loans that went to under 500 employees that are forgiven if and only if the workforces are maintained or rehired, that seems very good, very, very targeted. And then in terms of the Main Street response, I think if you're talking about federal stimulus, it's one of the most friendly Main Street bailouts probably that we've ever seen. You get $1,200 a person if you make less than $75K, $500 a child, unemployment benefits for 4 months, plus $600 on those. There's always going to be problems when you have a massive beast like the federal government trying to move adeptly on something like this. But those things, I think, are actually reason for a bit of celebration.
What are you thinking, Heather?
Well, I was just thinking that until the virus is at least more contained or more under control, there's no point in reopening the economy, because let's say Governor Pritzker tomorrow said, okay, it's over, or President Trump said, yep, go shop. I wouldn't, because I wouldn't have any confidence that I wouldn't become ill. So I feel like we're sort of putting the cart before the horse, in that we've got to get it under control to the point where people can get tested if they think they've been exposed, or if they're showing symptoms. And once testing is wider, then that's, I think, the first step. But I think we have to be most concerned about the hospitals and the ability of them to withstand what's coming. I mean, we've repeatedly heard Allison Arwady, the commissioner of public health here in Chicago, say it's going to get worse before it gets better. And the fact, you know, the economy won't work if people feel like they can't go out and be safe and not bring, you know, a really serious illness back home. So that has to happen first. So all of this sort of seems to me like a little bit like we're talking about, you know, whether or not I'm going to go get to see Weezer and Fall Out Boy at Wrigley Field this summer. You know, it's like we're magical thinking. We got to get the virus under control. We have to make sure that the hospitals have the capacity to treat those who get sick, because people will get sick. And, you know, we need ventilators. We need personal protective equipment. Like, we got to triage the crisis right now and then sort of go back and figure out what needs to happen, because people are going to die. Thousands of people are going to die.
And that's an excellent point that you make, which is that no matter what J.B. Pritzker says or Lori Lightfoot says or Donald Trump says about when we step away from this, the public is going to vote with its feet. Would you send your kids back to school now?
And
Easter Sunday.
I would
definitely not.
Yeah, and I'm sure that priests and, you know, other religious figures would say, Nick, no, it's, you know, we're not going to gather like this. We know it's not safe. I wouldn't go to the movies now. I wouldn't go contra dancing. I wouldn't do all these kind of things that I would like to do.
No, but I talk about Easter Sunday though. I mean, Heather, you were talking about the date, Heather. You were talking about the theology, right? When I said, did you go on Easter Sunday?
I was.
But when I heard Easter Sunday, and the president has this image of everybody shoulder to shoulder with bright smiling faces in the good Christian churches, I thought, I'm not getting in that thing. And that's not about religion or faith. That's about, I don't want to be that close to y'all. I don't want to go to a Cubs game on a warm, sunny day for I don't know how long.
Well, that's the problem, is that for weeks we were told by the federal government, not so much the state and local government, but that it was okay, that it was under control, that it was contained. That was language that came directly from the White House. That was not true. So now that there's you know, a crisis of confidence of how do we believe that these problems have actually been solved? I don't know the answer to that.
Well, how do any of you explain then that the president's approval ratings are now at an all-time high? He's at 49%. Among Republicans, he's 92%. And among Republicans, he's above 90% on his handling of the virus. Nationally, I know you just mentioned this, Eric, but think about this. His approval rating on the handling of the virus crisis, if you include independents and Democrats, is 60%.
So I know that you'll remember.
60.
Yeah.
So which is the one after 59. That one.
I know that you remember the time after 9/11 when George Bush had approval ratings in the 90s after the first Gulf War. The first president, George Bush, had 97% approval ratings. Whenever there's a crisis, there is a distinct instinct among Americans to rally around the president and to want to believe he's doing a good job. I think if you look at the president's approval ratings and you contrast those with governors who have ordered really stringent stay-at-home orders like Governor Pritzker, their approval ratings are significantly higher on their handling of the virus. And those two approaches are diametrically opposed. So I don't know that the polls are really telling us anything worth focusing on, because this is such a crisis and people instinctively want to say, yeah, everything, you know, he's doing a great job. Fine. We're not going to play politics about that. But, you know, I don't know that it actually means anything, or it is like, should be considered as, you know, sort of a sign that the country approves of what the president is doing.
Well, I don't know how you say that. I mean, 49% is 49%. If the election were tomorrow, I don't know.
I just don't know how you separate the president from the country at a moment of crisis. I think we've seen repeatedly that those pollings are sugar highs and aren't necessarily sort of truly reflective of what's going on.
Some of these polls were taken before this Easter Sunday declaration that he made, which I think startled a lot of people.
Easter is a very special day for many reasons for me, and what a great timeline this would be. Easter is our timeline. What a great timeline that would be.
When it gets down to it, he's going to declare victory. He's declared himself a wartime president. And by the time the election rolls around, the pandemic will have passed, we certainly hope. And that no matter how many people die, he will say that it would have been more if it hadn't been for the great Donald Trump. And he will declare himself a great leader with no regrets. That's inevitable. And some 40% of the population is going to believe him. The question is, are these people who are now kind of getting behind him and rooting for him going to stay with that when we review the tape and see what was done, what wasn't done, what should have been done, and so on. So I think it's way too early to tell what kind of impact this is going to have on the election. Joe Biden has been kind of nowhere.
Now they're talking about having a virtual convention.
That seems very likely to me. The Democrats, I think, are in July, right? Does anyone know the dates?
Correct. Yeah.
And the Republicans are in August. That'd be interesting.
The Republicans will pack in there. By God, if it was tomorrow, they'd show that virus. You know, when you think about the people who have contracted it, I started to make a list, and it reminds me a little of the one I had when #MeToo got momentum and people were coming out, and I thought, holy cow, look at this guy, now this guy, now this guy. And then I quit keeping track, and the same sort of thing happened to me. I had Rudy Gobert, then holy cow, Kevin Durant, Idris Elba, Tom Hanks, Rita Wilson, then the wife of the Canadian Prime Minister, Sophie Gregoire, then Harvey Weinstein this week, Rand Paul, Andy Cohen, Debbie Mazar, the actress. Yeah, Morocco's Prince Albert, Sean Payton from the New Orleans Saints. And then a lot of people who you don't know, but whose position would tell you they had opportunity to be informed and avoid it, like the health minister of Australia, or the home affairs minister of Australia, the mayor of Miami.
I'm curious to ask around the table here, does anyone know anybody well who has contracted COVID-19?
My brother is a Marine. He is stationed in Alabama, and I am pretty sure that he has recovered from coronavirus. And he was tested for the flu, but he tested negative for the flu, but there were no COVID-19 tests available for him. And he wasn't having severe symptoms. He did have some trouble breathing, but nothing serious. So they sent him home, and he was in there for about a couple weeks. He he's supposed to be quarantined until Sunday. But I got to say, it has been terrifying every morning to text him and keep my fingers crossed that he's okay, that he's not in the hospital, you know, that he is hanging in there. And the fact that somebody like Rand Paul, who wasn't showing any symptoms and felt well enough to go to the gym and go for a swim, got a test and my brother couldn't, you know, is a little bit hard to swallow, for lack of a better term. Oh, as I come close to losing my hard-fought journalistic objectivity on this topic.
Must make you crazy to see them all lined up shoulder to shoulder behind the President Pence and all the Dr. Fauci for the, Fauci for that matter. It's like, guys, optics, 6 feet, please.
Two arms length, people. It's not hard.
I don't know anyone in my immediate circles that has tested positive for it, but I will recommend folks should read this with a grain of salt. But The Atlantic put out a piece yesterday afternoon called "How the Pandemic Will End" by Ed Yong. One of the real things about that piece that stuck with me is almost everybody agrees you are going to know someone close to you who will have it. So I suggest reading that piece if only to. Right now is a period of great uncertainty, and what can be the antidote to that is to mentally prepare for the kinds of choices or the kinds of things you're going to be seeing over the next weeks and months. And that piece is very adept at doing that. The one thing I will say is that I don't think it spent enough time talking about the armies of brilliant people right now working on treatment options and even a vaccine. So I would only add that, but it's a good read to get yourself mentally prepared for what we might be seeing.
Yeah, just don't read it before bedtime. No, my advice.
Eric, do you know someone?
I don't. No, I don't yet.
I mentioned, I think, to you guys last week, didn't I, that my son's boss had it, and I also know maybe you guys know somebody like this who demonstrated the symptoms, like the sudden loss of taste and smell, and shortness of breath. And they go, well, I'm no epidemiologist either, but that looks like that's it. And this person's attitude was, well, I'm self-quarantined, so there's no point in getting tested. And I kept saying, I think you should get tested. A, I don't know how that person's going to do it. But B, they're like, what's the point? The treatment's going to be the same as what I'm doing. Stay home. You guys chastised me, or at least Eric did, I think, a couple weeks ago when I was saying not many people have it. You said not many people that you know of. What was the number? The people that have been tested, if you look at the number of tests in Illinois versus the number of people who have tested positive, it's 14%. 14% of the tests in Illinois have come back positive. Do the math on the state or the city. That's thousands and thousands of people. We all know somebody in that 14% if it's state or citywide.
Well, I think there certainly are people who have come down with it and been diagnosed with it who aren't talking about it too. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
There seems to be some sort of a stigma to it, but I don't see why.
I do. You don't?
Well, why you would? I mean, you don't get it because you've done something stupid.
Yes, you do. I think that's the stigma. You've been irresponsible or stupid. Who's getting it? The people at Clearwater, the beach in Clearwater, the people who weren't washing their hands, and the people that were blah blah blah.
I think that's right. The stigma, Eric. I think John's right, because we've been told that somehow this is avoidable, that if we follow the rules we can avoid this, and I don't know that that's actually true or fair, but that's where we are right now.
Maybe I stand corrected about that.
Well, you do now.
I mean, it just seems like it's so easy to transmit, and people who have it don't know they have it, and so you can get it from touching a gas pump handle. That doesn't seem to me to be reckless behavior, but maybe you're right. Maybe that's how people are looking at it.
Well, I think they're looking at it that way. I don't think that's entirely fair. I think both of you are saying something that's true. Austin, what were you going to say?
Yeah, embarrassment is one of Americans' biggest fears for a number of reasons. But I think, unlike other diseases, you need to, if you are diagnosed, reckon with everybody you have made contact with over the last 2 weeks, if you're being truly responsible about it, so that you can trace and that those people can quarantine as well. So it not only comes with the stigma of you having it, comes with the stigma of having to contact loved ones and acquaintances saying, hey, just so you know, this is what's going on.
Yeah, COVID-19 is the new STD, isn't it?
Sure.
What is your thought, Austin, on who is an essential worker? The Tribune had a story about people that make lemonhead candies are still going to work. I think some of them don't want to go to work. Some people do want to go to work, but they weren't so lucky as to be deemed essential. What's the thinking on that?
It's a Swiss cheese in terms of loopholes in essential workers under Pritzker's executive order. That's for sure. There's a ton of industry, including media, that are exempted. I've been talking with dozens of small business owners over the last 2 weeks because we're just getting flooded with all of these small business owners in our community that are either asking what they should do, asking about their healthcare options, asking about unemployment insurance for their workers. And I mean, their problem is you've got, say, a candy store, for instance. They have two problems. One, do we have workers come in? And two, who's going to buy our stuff? And their biggest problem, the biggest thing we're seeing people cry out for in the small business community, at least, whether they are in operation or not, is cash flow. That's a huge problem. We were talking about that earlier, kind of the nature of, you know, the economy is not going to get going until you've solved the virus. The point of the stimulus is not to fix the economy. It's to bridge the gap. You have no cash flow right now. And that wealth is not like a lake that you can take from. It's like a river that flows, and the river has stopped. So you need to get the cash flow going again. And then their second thing was usually some kind of tax relief or relief on their expenses. So that's what I'm hearing on the ground from some of those places.
Is there anything that really jumped out at you as stunning from the city, state, or federal level? I'll go first. I was really disappointed when the G7 was trying to issue a joint statement. The United States is in the position of leadership for the G7 right now, so they're going to author this shared document. And since they insisted on calling it the Wuhan virus, the other countries wouldn't sign on.
The whole administration's plan is to make sure that whenever the full extent of the damage is totaled up, that we then turn back and point the finger of blame at China. So it's their fault. They sent this over here. We did what we could. We did a terrific, tremendous job, but it's China's fault. And what else would possibly explain Trump's insistence on calling it the China virus? I mean, it did originate in China. There's no doubt about that. But I'm not sure what the point of reminding people about that all the time is, if not a political point.
Well, he was trying to settle the score because somebody in China, I hadn't heard this, said that they got it from U.S. soldiers.
I would like to begin by announcing some important developments in our war against the Chinese virus.
Why do you keep calling this the Chinese virus?
As you know, China tried to say at one point, maybe they stopped now, that it was caused by American soldiers. That can't happen. It's not going to happen. Not as long as I'm president.
By God, he's going to punch back 10 times harder. When is one of the Won't this be a great moment if one of the journalists gets a chance to ask the people behind the president exactly the question the president just answered and ask them if they 100% agree with it? We've had versions of that, but I'd like some of them to be a little more forthright on the science side about their disagreement with the president on some of his answers.
At some point, I feel like Anthony Fauci may just come and shove him aside and grab the microphone. the guy has had a long, distinguished career. He's 79 years old. What is to stop him from? I mean, he's not one of these guys who needs to worry about his next job or his consulting contract. He could just go up and push the president aside and say, no, here's what's going on. We're not closing down by Easter. We're probably not closing down by July 4th. And here's why. And then he can just drop the mic and walk off the
screen, you know. Fauci out.
Yeah,
exactly. Look, this is the fundamental issue facing the Trump administration and the people who work for the Trump administration. Each of them have to decide whether they're doing more good by standing alongside the president and attempting to correct his messages, or would they be better served by quitting in a blaze of glory and alerting, you know, and sounding the alarm. It's clear, watching Dr. Fauci, that his calculation is that he has an obligation to do what he can to protect the people that he can, and that it would be counterproductive for him to go directly at the president. But of course, we're all holding our breath for when he gets Jeff Sessions, right? Like where he gets, you know, it eases a little bit and he gets tossed out. But that, you know, is a fundamental question that everybody who works for the Trump administration has to answer. And let's not forget, back in the olden days of like a month ago, we saw four Department of Justice prosecutors quit because of the president's interference with the Roger Stone case. And that has all been memory hold now. But, you know, this is still the same president running the country in exactly the same way.
Doesn't that remind you of this very same conversation we had about his chief of staff? I owe it to the country to try and help him, save him from himself.
Yeah, doesn't it seem interesting to think about some of these stories that we thought were so important just not even all that long ago? It's hard to believe that it was just a little more than a week ago we had the election in Illinois. We were all talking about that for half a day, and then it just seems like it was forever ago.
Someone made this point on Twitter, but this is the first time in roughly a year, probably more, that Illinois corruption has not been headlined every week.
And crime in Chicago. I mean, literally, we called the police, we called the Anthony Guglielmi and asked him, was anybody shot? Because we haven't heard, like, is our shootings down? They are down a little bit, but not as much as the streets would make you think. Today would have been the opening day of the Major League Baseball season. I'd be at a White Sox game right now. So, Erica, you sometimes like to ask us, like, who do you think is going to win the election or whatever? When do you think we're going to get the all clear, whatever the hell that is? When do you think you'll feel comfortable going out?
Well, I just registered for Fiddle Camp in the end of July. And
like the gopher seeing its shadow, the groundhog.
Exactly.
And I'm holding out, I think, relatively decent hope that could happen. It's in the mountains of West Virginia in July. But that would seem to me to be, I think July, we're looking at July at the earliest is my guess, right?
One of the things that Atlantic piece made me really deeply consider was the fact that this doesn't, the turning of a page on a calendar does not necessarily signify that this is over, and that there's going to be flare-ups, there's going to be hot spots. This is going to be a continuous thing for probably the next year or more. And that might mean, you know, on a micro basis, yeah, maybe we can go out and start going back to work, maybe in the summer or the fall, but I wouldn't count that as going back to normal, because I think you could see actions like this, needing to happen, in the future again and again, if we don't find very effective treatment or vaccine options.
Heather?
Yeah, well, I don't think my kids are going back to school this year. We've been preparing them for that eventuality. And it's really sad because this is my daughter's last year at her elementary school, and she had been enjoying sort of being the oldest kid on campus and sort of getting ready for all of the end of year fifth grade stuff. I also don't think that my youngest daughter is going to make her first communion, as she was scheduled to at the end of April. And those are our big miles, would have been big milestones for our family. And I just feel sort of sad that they aren't going to happen, and that I can't really tell them, you know, when they will happen and sort of how we'll all come out of that. And it's definitely a really challenging time to be a parent of kids old enough to understand what's going on, but not really old enough to have their own understanding of what's happening. Because I mentioned teenagers can sort of, you know, think it through a little bit more, but, you know, a 7-year-old just wants to know why she can't play with her best friend. And that's, you know, it's a really hard conversation to have.
Yeah. Do they ask you, like, Mom, when is this going to be over?
We've tried to be really, you know, sort of proactive, saying, hey, we don't know when this is going to happen. You know, we're here now. We're safe. You know, we've got plenty to eat. We've got plenty of toilet paper. You know, we're going to have a good time. We're going to play games. You know, we're going to read some books. And, you know, we're going to take it one day at a time. But, you know, as sad as it is that everybody's missing opening day baseball, this is supposed to be their spring break. And, you know, they can't go to a museum or, you know, head to the park or anything like that. So that's, I think, part of the mental toll that this is all going to take on us that Austin was talking about. And we're not really going to be able to grapple with that until we're through this sort of initial phase.
The next date on my calendar that I'm hoping I'll get to achieve is a cruise. Go figure that. To Italy. Go figure that. And
Oh, God. Don't do it.
Well, what if I told you the year was 2025? Actually, it's October. So and I talked to the travel agent, and she said that whole line is shut down until the end of June. And she thinks maybe September they'll be up and running. And I'm thinking, okay, then I'll be one of the first cruises on that boat when they open her back up. And me, I'm of a mind to say, bring it on. I'm very excited about that still. One last question for you all. Is there something in your spaces now that you've noticed? Bruce Wolf, who I follow on Twitter, a local commentator and sometimes talk show host, said that he knows that he and his wife reached an inflection point when she told him that he was emptying his dishwasher a little too loudly. And I thought, yeah, I'll bet a lot of people are having these little social moments where they go, wow, and we got to get to April 7th and maybe longer. Austin, anything like that happen in your world lately?
My only cohabitation disagreement, I think I sprayed our counter spray a little too close to an open glass of water. That got me in trouble yesterday. And then other than that, I think we've been pretty good. My girlfriend's a teacher, so she's been doing a lot of, it's actually helped a lot because she has a gardening club. So she started doing videos of her growing stuff inside of just our apartment. So it's nice to see things growing is always nice to see. So And giving like the silver lining of, all these mutual aid organizations and all these meal trains and stuff, that's been really silver lining for me too.
Yeah. How about you, Eric? Has Joanna already tossed you out, I presume?
No, she's actually been very tolerant of me. We live on many stories here in this house. So I'm up in the attic most of the time and she's down at her office in the first floor. So we're able to like have sort of a normal life. My son is back from college, and that's been really pretty nice. He brought his girlfriend with him because they wanted to stay together, and they've been living in the basement. And they're both very pleasant people. And Ben and I have been able to play a lot of music together, which is really, really kind of a blessing.
The video of the two of you just made my day. So it looked good. I was so happy for the father's son. The music was really good too.
He's pretty good. So
we're hearing that now. And by the way, Heather, how about you? Everybody sharing the space happily?
We are. You know, we had a close call with an open water bottle in my computer, so a disaster was averted. But I am certainly the neatest person in my family, which bears its own special burden. But I have done my best to embrace the chaos as much as possible. We have two tents set up in our living room to give the girls extra sort of fun places to play and separate places to go when they get a little chippy with each other. But we're lucky that we have a tri-level. So our office is in the basement and I've been working on the first floor and my husband's been in the office.
Yeah.
We will drive each other nuts as much as we love each other.
I was refilling my wife's coffee and was told that my fingers were a little too close to the top of the cup, the drinking rim. And you know what? They were.
I'm sure I'm on Team Brenda here, John.
And that's probably a health practice I should have been practicing all along and now will going forward. Okay, guys. Well, this has been a long one, but it felt good. It's good to see you all. And I hope our listeners are enjoying listening to us connect and forgiving us for the quality of the microphones. But I think this worked out pretty well, Eric. Thanks for zooming us in on this.
Let's do it again.
Austin, Heather, Eric were produced this week by Ashley Byhun and Elif Garris too. Elif's working from home. I'm John Williams. We will drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.